Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You did something incredibly important last night, or at least I hope you did. When you climbed into bed for the evening and nodded off, you gave your body a chance for rest and repair. You put your brain to work filing away all the things you learned yesterday. You even set yourself up for a productive day at the office and decreased your chances of getting into an accident today. Considering all that, it's hard to understand why so many of us think of sleep not as a requirement for good health, but as a sort of luxury for all but small children. In fact, as my guest will tell us, good sleep hygiene may have as much to do with living a long, healthy, and even happy life as regular exercise and a proper diet. Dr. James Moss is professor and past chair in psychology at Cornell University and author of the books Sleep for Success and Power Sleep. He'll be back in town April 25th to teach a one-day university class called The Science of Sleep, Everything You Need to Know But We're Too Tired to Ask. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's just great to be here and to participate in the Metroplex. We just moved here 18 months ago from upstate New York, where I spent 50 years on the Cornell faculty. And it is so refreshingly warm and lacking in snow.
Yeah, the winters are better here than at Cornell.
Indeed.
Okay, so you're a psychologist. I wouldn't ordinarily associate psychology with sleep. How did this become such a passion for you?
I also have training in sleep medicine, so I refer to myself now as a sleep doctor. But, Chris, I have a funny story about that. When our eldest son was 7 years old, he came to me and he said, "Dad, why do they call you doctor? You don't give shots." So I sat this brilliant little boy down, and I spent maybe 30 minutes trying to explain to him the difference between an MD and a PhD. And I said, "Danny, it takes about 5, 6, or 7 years of intensive research, publishing something that has never been reported before in the scientific literature, to get a PhD, yada, yada, yada." I went on and on. I thought he had the concept down perfectly. The next morning, we're sitting in the kitchen having breakfast. The phone rings. Danny goes to get it. Somebody's obviously asking to speak to Dr. Moss. And without missing a beat, he said, "Well, I'll let you talk to him, but he's not the type of doctor who can do you any good." So I've been trying to do good in the next 30 years or so, and Danny's finally maybe agreeing, "Okay, Dad, you're okay." But way back in 1969, when I was teaching introductory psychology at Cornell, I had a class at that point of about 600 students. And I thought, we should be spending about a third of our life sleeping. So I better say something about that as part of human behavior. So I went out to Stanford, where Dr. William Dement, the grandfather of modern-day sleep research, was teaching. And I said, "Bill, can I film you capturing a dream?" And being somebody who's made a lot of films, I thought, I've got to bring this soporific topic to life in my class. So I went out. It was Thanksgiving evening in 1969, and Bill got one of his grad students to act as subject, and he wired him up with electrodes to measure his brainwave activity and his respiration. We put him into bed. 90 minutes later, and I was thoroughly jet-lagged, and we can talk about that later, I'm about to fall asleep because nothing's happening, and all of a sudden the pins on the polygraph machine went wild. And Bill looked at me and he said, "He's dreaming. Let's go capture the dream." And we walked into the bedroom, and he said, "Steve, what was just going through your mind?" As he awakened Steve. And Steve said, "I was having a dream." And he starts talking about this dream of witnessing a baseball game. That one instance so fascinated me that I said to myself, "I'm changing fields. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life." And I became one of the first people, there were probably 18 people in the world studying sleep and sleep medicine, to join that effort. And I've been doing it ever since.
What does the process of dreaming have to do with consolidation of memory and of learning and experiences that we've had the day before?
Everything. I don't focus very much on dreams and what they mean, although I think it's very important to analyze your own dreams. You don't need help to do that.
You don't need a book that says,
or a psychiatrist. Now, forget the shrink. Because you are the best reader and interpreter of your own dreams. You read dreams, as Freud said, for self-knowledge. So they help us explain what's on our mind. And what we often do, a Freudian technique, admittedly, is saying, okay, you just reported to me the literal aspects of the dream, but maybe there's something underlying that, something maybe you could call it subconscious or preconscious, that is the root of the reason why you're having that dream. So you talked about horses. What I want you to do, I'm going to say a few words, and you associate that word with other words. Horses, strong, stud, my dad, and now we're getting somewhere.
Right.
But dreams take place at various times during the night, usually every 90 minutes in a period we call REM, or rapid eye movement sleep. And they take place because of the firing of neurons in the lower brain stem activate the higher centers of thinking in the brain. And when you have very rapid neuronal activity, you bring down a content that fits that intensity of neural firing. So you have an active dream. Now, what you bring down, according to the Freudians, is something that's bothering you. According to other people, it doesn't really matter. In fact, we did an experiment where we had students sleep in the lab and then report their dreams. Every 90 minutes, we woke them up, something going through your mind, and they would tell us. And then in the morning, we would type out those dreams, and we would mix those dream reports with other students' dreams, and they were no better than chance at picking out their own dreams.
Wow.
So that is interesting. But there's so much more going on during sleep and during dreaming than just dreaming itself. And that's where we're going to get into memory and so many other important things. But I think it's important for people to know why it's important to get a great night's sleep in terms of your physical well-being, your emotional well-being, and your cognitive well-being. So let's just start out by saying about 70% of us have trouble sleeping two or three times a week. In fact, it's quite abnormal to find somebody who's a great sleeper. And most people need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep every night to be full of energy, alert, all day long. We've done surveys across the world. Most people say, when you ask them, how much sleep did you get last night? About 7 hours. But when you put instrumentation on these seven-hour sleepers that objectively records how much sleep they have, they overestimate. And they're not lying, but they just don't know. They overestimate by about 47 minutes.
Wow.
So somebody who's claiming that they sleep 7 hours is probably sleeping around six. And as we'll talk about, I'm sure, later in the program, high school and college kids from puberty to 24 years of age need 9.25 hours of sleep every single night to be fully alert all day long, and they average 6.1. That's more than a three-hour deficit every single night. And as you said at the opening, we treat sleep as a luxury. It is a necessity. So if you don't mind, I'd just like to tell our listeners a taxonomy, a litany of the consequences of not getting a great night's sleep. Okay?
Okay.
Can I do that? All right. First of all, you're drowsy. You have unintended sleep seizures. We call these microsleeps, when you think you're awake, but your brain is turned off for maybe as long as 90 seconds at a time. Then we have the physiological decrements. You have a significantly higher risk of hypertension, that's heart attacks and strokes, type 2 diabetes, irritability, anxiety, clinical depression, weight gain, slowered reaction time. And I know we're going to talk about athletes and sleep. You might think you're just an average athlete, but by changing your sleep, we can make you a star literally overnight. And we're doing it at prep schools, at high schools, in colleges, with Olympic athletes, with the NHL, the NBA, the NFL, with amazing results. Some of these pros have very little headroom to improve, and we can make that improvement within days, if not literally overnight. Then we have slowed reaction time, which is important for athletes. And here's the big rub that you mentioned before, cognitive performance, your ability to think, to remember, to be creative, to make critical decisions is significantly affected by lack of sleep. And it's the best predictor we have of longevity. Exercise, as you mentioned, is important. Nutrition is important. But the most important of all, the best predictor of how long you're going to live is the quantity and quality of your sleep.
All right, the perfect place to stop. We'll come back to all of these things in just a minute. My guest is Dr. James Moss, professor and past chair in psychology at Cornell University, author of books including Sleep for Success and Power Sleep. He'll be speaking, teaching a one-day university class on April 25th called The Science of Sleep, Everything You Need to Know, But We're Too Tired to Ask. If you've got a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with Dr. James Moss.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with sleep scientist Dr. James Moss. He will be teaching a one-day university class April 25th entitled The Science of Sleep, Everything You Need to Know, But We're Too Tired to Ask. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Okay, Jim, so you said many of us who think we're sleeping 7 hours are getting closer to 6 hours. We might need as much as 9. And yet not that many people walk around saying, I am sleep deprived. So how do we know if we're not getting enough?
That's a great question. We're going to go over that in detail in the one-day university. But I should add that that one-day university is not a full day. It's only the morning. If I went the full day, I surely would put you to sleep. But we do have a quiz. The ideal way to see if you're sleep deprived is to do an all-night sleep recording. Or what we do as an alternative is called the multiple sleep latency test, where you come into the lab, we put electrodes on you so you can't fake sleep. We can objectively measure whether you go to sleep or not. We give you a challenge. We give you a quiet, dark, cool bedroom, and we say, you have 20 minutes. Go to sleep as quickly as you can. Now, if you fall asleep, we wake you up right away, and we say, come back in 2 hours, and we'll give you another 20-minute test. And we do this throughout the day, from 8 in the morning right through to 6 at night. If you don't go to sleep on any of these 20-minute episodes, we say, wow, you're fully alert. Now, we find that young kids, prepubescent, are the most wide-awake segment of our population. They never go to sleep on any of these 20-minute trials. I mean, you've had them. You come home from work, and you're kind of dragging, and there they are at the door. Mom, Dad, let's go play.
Sure.
You say, where do you get that energy? They get it because they've had adequate sleep. And you and I could be just like that if we paid attention and valued sleep. That's our benchmark for full alertness. the people who are most sleepy are people who have narcolepsy or sleep apnea but have yet to be treated. They will be asleep within 3 to 5 minutes on every single trial throughout the day, even though they might have spent 10 hours in bed the night before. That's our benchmark for total sleepiness. In the middle are senior citizens who usually fall asleep within 8 or 9 minutes on most trials, especially during the middle of the day in that midday dip in alertness after lunch. And Fortune 500 CEOs, if you ever want to get anything by the boss, it's easy. Hold a meeting about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Show PowerPoints. Ask whatever the heck you want. Don't bother me, sure. Just take the whole darn company. Where are high school and college kids? Are they with the 72-year-old senior citizen or the corporate CEO? No, they have sleep latency curves identical to the pathologically sleepy narcoleptic or untreated sleep apneic. You know, we're trying to get kids in school at 7 or 8 or even 9 in the morning. That's the middle of their night, and we should talk in detail about that and what to do about their grade point average, their athleticism, etc. The solution is actually easy. But rather than drag you into the sleep lab, answer these 5 questions, because your answer is a good predictor of how well or poorly you do in the sleep lab. So question number 1, just yes or no. Does a warm room, a boring meeting, a low dose of alcohol, or a heavy meal, or listening to a lecture or radio program like this make you sleepy? Yes or no. Number 2, do you fall asleep within 5 minutes of hitting the pillow? Number 3, do you need an alarm clock to wake up in the morning? Number 4, do you hit the snooze button repeatedly? And number 5, do you sleep extra hours on the weekends? Answer yes to any 2 or more of those questions and consider yourself pathologically sleep deprived, whether you feel it or not. And you've got to get help. And that help will almost instantly improve your mental attitude, your athleticism, your academic ability, and your performance on the job. And in our half-day, one-day university seminar, we're going to go over how to conquer all of those issues and make you into the person that your mom had hoped she had given birth to.
Boy, that's a big promise right there. Okay, we have a question here via email from Wanda, who says, how do you turn off your brain so you can go to sleep? Even when you are really tired, sometimes it's hard to calm down.
That's absolutely true, Wanda, and a common complaint that we have, especially with type A personalities who don't get enough sleep in the first place, and they don't get quality as well as quantity of sleep that's required. So let me give you some rules and some strategies, which will go into great detail on the 25th. First of all, we've got what I call the golden rules of good sleep. Number 1, determine your sleep requirement and meet it every night. For most of us, as a rule of thumb, it's 1 more hour than we're getting right now. If both of your parents were short sleepers and wide awake all day, you might be one of the lucky 5% that can do okay on even 6.5 to 7 hours of sleep. Number 2, this is as important as quantity, is quality. And what you have to do to get quality sleep is to maintain a regular sleep-wake schedule. Go to bed and get up at the same time, Monday through Monday, including the weekends. We have 1 biological clock, Chris, not 1 for the work week, 1 for the weekend. You must be consistent so the hours you spend in bed correspond to the sleepy phase of your circadian rhythm. Number 3, get continuous sleep. 1 long block of sleep, not a long nap in the afternoon, an hour in the easy chair after dinner, falling asleep in front of the TV. It is normal to wake up several times during the night. What's abnormal is to remain awake for longer than 15 or 20 minutes. And we call that insomnia. And there are so many good strategies now, other than sleeping pills, which can kill you, that we have to follow. And we can talk about it here and in the program on the 25th. No caffeine after 2 in the afternoon, because that ruins REM sleep at night. Even decaf is not a good idea, because all decaf drinks have caffeine. Your bedroom has to be quiet, dark, and cool, about 65 to 67 degrees. No TV, electronics, iPads within an hour of bedtime, because all of these monitors put out a lot of daylight spectrum light, which block melatonin. So when you do turn off the lights and get in the dark to try to go to sleep, melatonin, having been blocked, is going to delay your sleep onset by as much as 45 minutes to an hour. No alcohol within 3 hours of bedtime. My students used to say, "Moss, you don't know what the heck you're talking about. If I drink myself to oblivion, I'll fall right to sleep." You will, but you'll be up every 90 minutes thereafter. During REM sleep, you will wake up. Exercise, very important. Best about 5 to 7 at night, not right before bedtime, with heavy cardio exercise other than sex. And a lot of executives say, "I'm so busy, the only time I have to exercise is early in the morning." That's okay if you've had adequate sleep, if you had your 7 to 9 hours, and you stretch for 20 to 30 minutes before you get on the treadmill or go jogging outside, because you'll be much more prone to injury early in the morning, and it's not close enough to your bedtime to really affect the quantity and quality of your sleep the way we'd like to see it. We want you to keep mentally fit. Power naps, that's a term that I invented 40 years ago, and we can talk about power naps, Chris, if you want to, how to take one, how long it should be. Getting a hot bath or a jacuzzi right before bedtime. Do mental relaxation, yoga. That will help block your mind because you can't get to sleep. Have a worry time just before you turn out the lights. List on a piece of notepaper from your bedstand all the things that are happening on your mind. Then you won't wake up in the middle of the night thinking about them.
Because you finished them already.
And you can't do anything about it while you're sleeping anyway, so you have your list for the morning. There are a lot of other things we can talk about, but that's a long-winded answer, Wanda, to your very good question.
Is it possible to sleep too much?
That's another great question. Some people say, "Well, I'm limited in my sleep during the week because of work, so I sleep extra on the weekends, but I feel lousy when I sleep 10 hours. The reason is you're not used to that. You're not used to waking up later, and your temperature has risen, so you feel out of sorts. But on all sorts of perceptual tasks, cognitive tasks, you're actually brighter and better. And that grogginess will disappear. The only people who are oversleeping are people who are clinically depressed or people with a brain injury like elephantiasis.
So our bodies are basically going to wake us up when we've had adequate sleep.
Right. People say, "How long should I sleep?" I say, until you can't sleep anymore.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. James Moss. His books include Sleep for Success and Power Sleep. He'll be in town April 25th teaching a one-day university class called The Science of Sleep, Everything You Need to Know But We're Too Tired to Ask. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Dr. James Moss.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with sleep scientist Dr. James Moss, author of the book Sleep for Success and Power Sleep. He will be teaching a one-day university class April 25th called The Science of Sleep, Everything You Need to Know But We're Too Tired to Ask. So, Jim, I find it almost impossible to nap, and I think it's because I'm really careful about getting enough sleep at night. But what is a power nap, and how long does it need to be, and can we overnap?
Great questions. A power nap is a nap or a rest period in the middle of the day, typically in the midday dip of alertness, which is a regular portion of our circadian rhythm, about 8 hours after we get up. Now, a lot of people think that heavy meal at lunch is what's making me sleepy, but you're going to be sleepy whether you have a heavy meal or a low dose of alcohol or not. About 40 years ago, I was working, as I did for 15 years, as a consultant to IBM, and they were talking about power breakfasts and power lunches. And I said, rather than take a coffee or a Coke break in the middle of the afternoon, which is going to ruin your sleep that night, destroy your REM sleep, why not take what I termed a power nap? And boy, do I wish now I had not only coined the term, which I did, but put a copyright on it, because now it's ubiquitous. I defined a power nap as 15 to 20 minutes, any longer, and it might cause nocturnal insomnia, or make it a lot harder to fall asleep right away. And it might make you groggy when you wake up from that nap at work. So for the next hour or two, you could be worthless productivity-wise. So 10 to 15 to 20 minutes is all you need. If you really need more and have the time to have more, never 60, but 90 minutes, a complete REM cycle, so you don't wake up out of deep sleep. And if the boss comes by and taps you on the shoulder when your head is down on your desk and say, "What are you doing?" Before you raise your head, just say, "Amen," and then put your head up and look at your boss. "What can I do for you, boss?" But people who power nap on a regular basis have a 37% less chance of a heart attack or a stroke, and they're much happier and robust. So power naps are really a good thing.
Earlier in the hour, you talked about working with athletes who try to be really careful about diet and sleep habits and everything else, but what did you learn specifically about what people need to do to have the best physical performance?
The athlete certainly pays attention to exercise, certainly to nutrition, but very few have any concept of the fact that the most important thing they can do to increase their reaction time, their willingness to participate in helping other teammates on the field or off the field, has to do with the quantity and quality of their sleep. So we have marvelous case histories. I love these, of people who come to us, we put them on a sleep regimen, and literally overnight, they improve their performance. One of my favorite examples is a little girl, 15 years old at the time, wants to be a professional figure skater, wasn't getting any better, so she wanted to quit. She has the finest skating coach in North America, the finest sports psychologist in the world. Nothing was doing any good. Her parents called me. They were both former students of mine 38 years ago at Cornell. And they said, "Prof, we've seen you on Oprah, the Today Show. We're hearing all about these great things you've done with athletes. Would you talk to our daughter? We're not pushy parents, but we think she has real potential." And I said, "Well, I'd be glad to." And I met this charming 15-year-old girl. And I asked her how much sleep she was getting. She didn't really know, because her daily routine was to get up at 4 every morning, be at the rink at 4:30, skate for 2 hours, have breakfast, go to school, go back to the rink at 4 in the afternoon for another 2 hours. All competitive figure skaters do two-a-days, as the swimmers do. Then she would do a little bit of homework, have a little dinner, and crash, barely getting five and a half hours. I said, "Do you want to improve?" She said, "Yeah, but nothing's doing any good. I'm going to quit." And I said, "Look, read my book." She said, "Well, my dad's going to make me do it anyway, so I guess I will. But I don't think it'll do any good. Follow all the strategies and the tips that we talk about, and no more early morning skating. And she started to cry. Niagara Falls tears. And I said, "What?" to her dad, "What did I say?" The first time she doesn't show up at 4:30 in the morning, word will be out worldwide on the internet that she's a joke, no longer competitive. I said, look, she needs 9.25 hours of sleep because she's not getting any sleep spindles in her motor cortex that will enable her to do triple jumps, etc. And so I explained what the sleep spindles were, how to get it back into her sleep. So she said, I'll try it for a month. Within a month, she was doing jumps, spins, turns that she could never do before. She was put on the Olympic team as kind of a last chance, not expected to do anything. 2002, Salt Lake City, Sarah Hughes took the gold medal. And we have cases of track stars, high school kids, professional marathon runners, hockey players who have all had that great experience.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Allison in Bedford. Hello, Allison.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks, I'm enjoying the program. My teenager that I have a question about is a swimmer, so I took a lot of notice of the last question, taking notes.
Oh, great.
My daughter is 14, and I see that she has pretty good sleep, but I notice all of her friends have crazy sleep schedules. And I'm wondering if there's any truth to, do they really need more sleep at that age? And are there any exceptions to the rules for teenagers?
No, there are no exceptions to the rule. Athletes usually need closer to 10 hours, especially teenagers. We just wrote a book, Haley Davis and I. She's a student at Cornell, called Sleep to Win. It's a fable. You can read it within an hour, and it has all the case histories, all the information you have to become a better athlete overnight. University of Michigan swim coach, he always wins. That team always wins the national championship in swimming. He heard me talk about 4 months ago. He came up to me afterwards. He said, you know, we've been doing two-a-days like every other swim team in the country. After listening to you, I know it's stupid. Starting tomorrow morning, we will no longer do two-a-days, just afternoon. And what a difference it made, even to the number one team in the world.
How do you convince people that they really need more sleep? You don't hear really successful people boasting about how little exercise they get or bragging about how much junk food they eat. But lots of people who are considered powerful and admirable like to tell everybody how little sleep they survive on.
Yeah, it's a mark of being macho, but it's totally wrong. There are a few people who can get by on less than the required amount of sleep for most people. And as we look at people who brag, like Thomas Edison said, sleep's a waste of time. But we have pictures of him falling asleep on lab benches, taking two-hour naps during the day. In fact, at both his Fort Myers and New Jersey labs, he has a bed in his office. But he never counted that. For all the people who brag they need very little sleep, number one, people who go on very little sleep typically die early. So Janis Joplin used to brag, you know, why sleep so much? You might miss a good party. She died at the age of 27. Case closed.
What is the relationship, before we let you go, between longevity and sleep? Is it a thing about, you know, sleep preserves the telomeres and keeps them long? Or do we know why people who sleep well live longer?
Typically, yes, because people who don't get adequate sleep have heart attacks, strokes, cancer. We now know that sleep deprivation is a cause of breast cancer and colorectal cancer. Not a correlation, a cause. Alzheimer's disease. Sleep deprivation lowers the immunity in your body, and that is a huge hit that you should not be willing to take.
Dr. James Moss is author of books including Sleep for Success and Power Sleep. He will be teaching a one-day university class on April 25th called The Science of Sleep, Everything You Need to Know But We're Too Tired to Ask. Jim, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. We really appreciate your participation in the program. Thanks.